Hi, welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, your monthly potpourri of literary snacks for the mind. I'm Sandy Harper here with my co-host Dick Reichman and an extremely extraordinary, very special guest, Leigh Newman. And I'll tell you why she's extra special. Of course, her book is fantastic, but this is another reason she's extra special. When she was a young teenager, she used to come to Cyrano's bookstore back in the glory days when Cyrano's was a wonderful bookstore. And she wrote me an email note that she used to hang out there and dream, but not of being a writer, but of being a bookstore owner. That so touched my heart, Leigh. Yeah.
No, I used to love it. I used to sit and read the children's picture books, and I don't know. I just thought one day this was, you know, this cultural oasis for me. You know, I thought, wow. I don't know. I actually spent many hours there, especially afterward. I got off work at 3, and I'd stay there till about 5.
Well, you actually did become a virtual bookstore owner because of your current job with Oprah.com.
Yeah, I am the books editor at Oprah.com, and it's been wonderful because I can support all different kinds of books, giving them review and bringing them to the attention of, you know, literally, you know, millions of people. And I can pick small books. I love a book by an indie publisher or finding a little gem that, you know, no one's really heard before and bringing that. Or a wonderful big name book, you know, where you just get to celebrate, wow, this is writing at its finest and the whole world is celebrating and I get to join in on that too.
And sometimes meet those authors, I guess.
Yeah, I do. I work with a lot of established authors on doing original essays. Worked with Karen Russell and Jim Shepard and Toni Morrison and Jeffrey Eugenides. Really exciting stuff.
Definitely impressed, but I am also impressed. I am sitting down with an author today, though, and Leigh Newman has written the most wonderful book called Still Points North, Surviving the World's Greatest Alaskan Childhood.
Yeah, you know, they actually changed, unfortunately, at that copy, they changed the subtitle of the book, so it's called Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home.
That really does describe it better, I guess.
Yeah, I had no control of that. That was Random House at its finest, picking a better subtitle, which makes more sense.
Yeah, well, you know, I know a lot of people here are writers. There's an Alaskan genre now. There are a lot of people writing books. And, of course, we're so proud of Ellen Ivy.
I know. And I'm so excited we're going to read with her tonight at 7.
Well, actually, past tense, we're taping this show in advance.
Oh,
and
sorry.
Lucky you might have been at Cyrano's on Friday night and heard a double whammy, double feature book reading and signing. Yeah.
She's been wonderful, actually. I just emailed her. That's, you know, I emailed her before, many months ago, and said, you know, I really love The Snow Child, and I'd like to talk to you about books. And she emailed me back, and we started talking. She's a wonderful person, and her book is just outstanding.
Right.
Well, so beautifully imagined.
Well, it's only the third Alaskan book ever nominated for a Pulitzer Prize fiction.
I know. Isn't it exciting?
Very exciting.
I was bursting with pride. I've been Facebooking about it nonstop. She probably thinks I'm a stalker. Yeah.
Well, you know, writing a book, and especially a memoir, though hers is fiction, that's such a courageous thing to do. And it's such a gift, too. It's a gift to your family and parents because now they know what you were thinking all those times and how you were pursuing things.
Well, it was a little risky for me. You know, I was uncomfortable about writing nonfiction. And when I sat down to write the memoir, I'm not sure whether I knew what I was doing, you know, because, you know, we are private and many of the thoughts I'd had been in my head for so many years. But when I started writing about things like fishing for salmon, my first king, you know, spending time with Dad in the bush, a lot of the book is about in the wilderness, me and my dad trying to piece things together when my family was falling apart. And that really became the heart of the book, the first scene where my dad and I are out fishing after my mom had left. It never changed. Once I started writing those parts of the book, they never changed. I hardly changed a noun or an adjective in them. It was as if I'd been sort of waiting to write this book my whole life. I just didn't know that I wanted to write about my dad and I in the wilderness fishing for salmon. I didn't know that. You know, I thought I wanted to write what everybody else was writing, you know.
Well, what was the catalyst? I mean, did you eat a madeleine or some salmon?
Yeah, wouldn't that have been great if I ate some salmon jerky and I was transported into the past? No, I mean, I think I was always writing it in my head. I just, you know, was looking at flashbacks. But what happened was I wrote a novel about Alaska, and I was actually, it was a little bit, you know, kind of a comic novel, and it was really fun writing it, but it didn't really work. You know, it was a bit funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm actually, even though there's a lot of humor in the memoir and a lot of jokes,
oh, it's
a serious book. I know.
I love it.
Well, but I don't know whether the funny book I was writing was that funny. I think it might have been a little bit, it just didn't come together. And I kind of failed. I felt at the end that I'd failed when I wrote my novel. And sometimes failure is wonderful. Mm-hmm. Failure can really inspire you to do better or to do differently in my case. Because I didn't walk away from that failure saying, oh, I'll write another novel that will work. I said, I've got to do something different because I'm so brokenhearted. I got to do something different and I'm too afraid to write another novel. So I sat down and I knew I was very pregnant with my second child and I knew I had a very limited window of being able to do something before the second child was born. I had a good idea that my life was going to radically change, and I started to write just about my family. I started to write about mosquitoes, you know, started to write, oh, there comes a black bear. Okay, good. Okay, there comes some rapids, raft trip. And then, you know,
it just flowed.
Yeah, it came really, really quickly. It was, at certain parts, I mean, writing a memoir is really like being an ice skater, and you're skating on not thin ice, but a couple of inches, and underneath is everything that you've ever done and every other person in your life. The little faces are pressed up against that ice looking at you. And you have to skate pretty quickly. I mean, you have to be very aware of looking at them, but skate pretty quickly or you're really going to fall into a mess of yourself, you know? So you have to keep moving. Well, yeah. And you can fix it later. You just have to say, I'll keep moving. I'll get through this scene. I don't want to be in this time period, or I do want to be in this time period, or I'm worried about what other people will think. And you just have to keep moving, keep moving, keep moving, keep skating, keep skating, keep skating. And at the end, you can figure out, well, what am I going to do with all this material?
Yeah, you mentioned in the book that you had, the middle section was cut out, because I want to know what that was, too.
Yeah, I had 400 pages at the end. 400 pages that did not read like a great story.
Mm-hmm.
So we took out, and I did everything I could trying to fix it, trying to make the middle part, you know, really compelling. But it just wasn't compelling. It was more of the same part that had happened in the first 100 pages. So we pulled out those 120 pages in the middle, and that left us with a very book that had half my life. The first half was really about me growing up in Alaska and my family kind of falling apart. And the second half was about my own family falling apart and thinking about the past in Alaska and how that had informed what was going on in my adult life as I traveled around the world.
Oh, yeah, that side chapter of being a travel writer, how exciting.
Yeah, I think growing up in Alaska and becoming a self-sufficient person was what led me to be a travel writer, you know? When you grow up flying and fishing and hunting and, you know, you're not as afraid. It's not so scary to go to Nepal and track tigers, you know? It's pretty exciting. You know? I mean, not that it ever would be scary, but it was great, you know?
Well, there was a little bit there about crashing the ballet company.
Yeah. I was traveling around Russia at the time. There was mostly mafia-controlled Moscow and St. Petersburg, and had a lot of adventures there working with the ballet troops there. You know, how these ballet troops were functioning after the fall of the Soviet regime. They had no food to feed anybody, no heat. They were working 12 hours a day. And then as I was covering them, of course, I had to deal with all these mafia guys who were constantly running my car off the road and asking me out or showing up my hotel room with a machine gun. And
that's how you knew they were mafia guys.
Oh, yeah. You don't mistake the mafia. They're very handsome. They're rich. They're very well dressed. And they don't actually carry a weapon, but they have their friend behind them that has the weapon. And then you just...
Wow.
Try and be polite but firm.
Polite
but firm.
Good.
We're not going out tonight. I'm feeling tired. Goodbye.
I'm washing my hair.
Yeah.
So, well, for those who are just tuning in, you're listening to Alaska Radio Reader Ramblers. I'm your host, Sandy Harper, with my co-host, Dick Reichman. And our guest is Leigh Newman, author of Still Points North, a most wonderful book. Read it, read it, read it. You'll find out not only about Alaska, but about relationships and about family and many other things.
Thank you. I wanted the book to be, as I wrote the book, I realized I was falling in love with my family. You know, it was kind of, I mean, I already loved my family, right? But as I wrote the book, I was understanding, you know, what happened. My mom had struggled with mental illness and a little bit of alcoholism. And I began to understand what her life was like. You know, since my parents were divorced and my mom lived in Baltimore, and my dad lived in Alaska, they had very different realities. And I realized how hard it was for my mom to be a single parent and struggle with her mental issues and her whole family. And then as I wrote about my dad, you know, I realized how hard it was for him you know? I guess we weren't one of those families that just took divorce lightly, you know? It was hard.
Well, I'm sure it's painful and troublesome for anyone who goes through this because of that two different worlds.
Yeah.
And you're a member of both of those worlds. But what you took was that quantum leap to realizing your parents are complicated human beings in their own right, not just mom and dad.
Yeah, no, of course, I am too. I had to look at my own behavior and look at everybody's, try and understand why things had happened the way they would. I mean, I know that my dad did everything he could to be this amazing father. I mean, you know, I call him the Great Alaskan Father in the book. And, you know, he taught me how to hunt. He taught me how to fish. He taught me how to shoot a gun. He taught me how to cook. He taught me how to make a smoothie, you know? He taught me how to sew. He actually taught me how to hand sew and sewed my pixie hat for me for the pixies up here at Scenic Park Elementary when I was a pixie and a brownie. He sewed on my patches for me.
And to survive.
We had a lot of hairy close calls, you know? And which I talk about in the book, you know, the most dramatic being when we were caught in an updraft and in an airplane and went up to 20,000 feet and... You know, basically had oxygen deprivation, turned blue, and of course started laughing hysterically. We're gonna die! I think we're in trouble. And luckily, we lived. Luckily, a downdraft took us back down.
Yeah, you guys have like cats have nine lives. How many do you guys
have? I know. And then at the end of the book, I talk about, you know, one night we camped out and the tide came in and flooded us, and we ran out of the tent, and the plane went drifting down the river, and Dad just jumped in the water and swam as fast as he could. I think that people in the lower 48 don't understand that when you get in trouble in the wilderness in Alaska, especially during this period of the late 70s and early 80s, you know, there were no cell phones and there were no roads. And if the plane went down the river, that was it with all your gear. You know, I don't even think we had a gun and if we had, the gun was underwater. You know, it would have been a tough couple weeks finding somebody to take care of us or figure out that we were gone.
It was weeks?
No, it would have been if he had not caught that plane.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Gotten us back, you know, if he had not caught the plane, we were going to be out there for a significant amount of time. And everything that we had that would have kept us warm and dry was gone, you know. I don't want to do that. I've got two words. I don't want to do that.
But so. Even when you write about these stunning incidents. It's with great humor. There's always a cut line in there. There's always a beautifully crafted line that's so exciting to read.
Thank you. I think a lot about sentences, and I think I came to this, you know, I've been writing for 20 years. I've been writing since I was 16 years old. Well, I'm 40 now, so longer than 20 years, in private, thinking about sentences, reading and reading and reading, reading Cormac McCarthy, reading Faulkner, reading, you know, I read Shakespeare over and 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 over again. I have probably 10,000 flashcards of words that I would look up the word histories and think about words. I mean, when I finally wrote a book, you know, I was thinking about sentences as much as I was thinking about the story. I was thinking about the English language. I was thinking about how Milton created words. I tried to create, you know, but subtly, you don't write to just show off that you think about
curiosity.
Sentences. Yeah. With the idea, or I think the ideal, is that you think about sentences and then you grow a little older so you don't have to be a show-off. And then they can just try and make the purest, most beautiful stroke you can, just like a painter. You know, you want to make a light and beautiful stroke, draw no attention to it, and keep going with the story. So that's something that Stegner does, just beautifully.
Oh, yes.
You know, great Alaska. I mean, a great Western writer.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, was it your teachers who had great influence for you to start keeping a journal to be such an in-depth researcher on your own?
No, I went a little bit of an autodidact. When you come to that. I had a couple writing teachers, but I never really had a mentor, anybody who kind of, I guess that I just, I'm Alaskan. I keep talking about the self-sufficiency. Maybe there were teachers who wanted me to take me under their wing, or writing teachers, but I always was kind of writing on my own, and I never really had that great match with that teacher that understood what I was doing and wanted to shepherd me along. Probably the closest I've come to it is now Karen Russell. She read the book. Karen Russell, the author of Swamplandia, she read the book.
Yeah.
When I sent her a draft, I sent her a galley, and she has just been championing the book and going around and going to bookstores and getting people to get riled up about the book, and it's been a huge honor.
That is so wonderful. That's kind of the same thing you're passing on to everyone.
Yeah, yeah. It's really great when someone takes notice and sits up and understands what you're trying to do with the craft or with the story. I'm very, very grateful to her.
You know, I'm curious because this book is highly revealing of your life and your family. And you said you sent a draft to your family.
Yeah, I did.
What was their response?
Well, you know, they knew I was writing the book because I had sold my book on a partial and I had been working on it for 2 years. So they were aware, but I don't think I was aware of what I was writing. Mm. I mean, it wasn't like I was hoodwinking anyone. I was, you know, I was marching along with the Nile. You know, I thought I was writing a book about hunting and fishing. And I think my parents did too. So my dad would say, "Oh, did you remember the time that we went on the crevasse and we almost fell down?" Yeah. And I was sort of writing that book. It was about hunting and fishing and hiking and skiing, you know, and flying and smoking fish. It was all that. But underneath it was, of course, the story of my family and how we sort of struggled. And when it did come out, my mom was very shocked, and so was my dad, and so was I. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know what I'd written. And I hadn't even given it to my editor yet. We had a lot of heart-to-heart talks. It took a lot. And my parents ultimately said, you know, we want you to publish the book. You know, we're behind you. We don't want to come out in public and talk about it, and you know, but we are behind you and we want you to publish the book. And so I did. But if they had said, no, we don't want you to publish the book, it wasn't going to get published. Because I love my family. There's no way I was not going to rip my family apart a second time.
That love is evident in the book, but also truth-telling is evident in the book.
Yeah. You got to tell the truth in memoir, otherwise it's not worth it. Yeah. You know, I knew that early on, and I didn't want to.
Right.
It wasn't like I sat there going, oh, let's bring up this tough time, and won't that be fun?
Mm.
But at a certain point, I realized if I was going to write a memoir, which is what I was doing, I had to go all the way. Otherwise, it would have been for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, writing a memoir and exposing yourself and bringing everybody to light and then not really telling the truth is sort of like, why would you risk all that for nothing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of my favorite lines in the book was what your grandmother told you
when
you visited her when she was dying.
About being joyful?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was your gift.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that was she did that, and it was so interesting when she was dying. I didn't write this in the book, so I went to go see my grandmother who was dying, and my dad and I were cleaning her and caring for her, and up all night and moving her body around and helping her, which is a privilege. If anybody has this experience to help someone die, it can be one of the world's most important and greatest honors. And as I was doing it, she kept asking me to read.
Mm-hmm.
I'd written some little short stories, and she would like to sit there when she was lucid. She'd say, read me that little short story. And when she told me, I was at a very dark period of my life. I had left my husband. I was very lonely. I felt very badly about myself. I felt that I had ruined things for everybody. And she didn't know about any of it. And she did say, she said, you know, your gift is that you bring joy to everybody. And the irony of that, you know, I felt like I had really messed up everybody. So it was a great gift that she gave me.
That you can well believe.
And
now.
I had to write it down. Do you know what? When she said it, I thought, I'll write this. I better write this down, because if I don't, I know I'm going to forget it. My mind is such that I will X this out and I'll never remember it. So I better write it down. I have it written down in this literary journal or something that I
That's
had with
great.
Me.
Well, it was a very moving moment in the book. It really
Thank
is.
You. Yeah, it was a. She probably saved my life on that one by saying that to me.
And I also loved your relationship and with your significant other.
Yeah, Lawrence.
I don't want to give away any surprises because it's just wonderful as it unfolds,
the
story of Leigh's relationship with her guy.
Yeah. Well, the book, I really do consider the book a love letter to Alaska, you know, and all the lessons in Alaska that I took with me everywhere I went. But one place that, you know, life took me was meeting my husband. And the second part of the book really is the story of our romance, you know, from the good times to the very bad times to the good times again. And, you know, I do think that, you know, my growing up in Alaska and being so independent and knowing my own way was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. But I think when that combined with my family's kind of cataclysmic divorce, I became so independent. It was very, very hard for me to imagine, you know, what marriage would be like, or what having your own family, what even having a guy around, you know,
right.
what even having furniture would be like. I lived in an apartment without any furniture. I traveled. I didn't, you know, really stick around. I was good for people for a couple of hours, and then I had to go do my own thing. And somehow Lawrence just wormed his way in there, didn't he? just by charm, intelligence, and persistence. I guess his greatest Alaskan quality was persistence. He did not give up on me.
He was tenacious.
Yeah.
But also sounds very funny. So you guys have a lot of laughs together.
Oh, he is so funny.
Yeah.
He's got that dry Irish humor where you don't even know that he's telling a joke. It takes you about 2 years to realize that he's way funnier than you.
Yeah. That's great. You know, I'm also, did he ever tell you why, you know, in the book you say, across the crowded room.
Yeah.
And he sent a liaison, like, you know, Cyrano.
Yeah.
And
he did.
To have you come over. Did he ever reveal to you just what it was? That
I don't know. There are still mixed stories, because what happened was we were at a party in New York, and it was up on a terrace, and this guy came up to me, and he said, you know, my friend has been staring at you for hours, and I'd like you to come over and meet him. I did not see Lawrence. I just saw the friend, and I said, okay, well, you know. But I'm not, I said, I don't date people or whatever, but, you know, I'll go over there, meet your friend. I was so bitter, you know, and I clomped over there. And to this day, I say, well, did you really see me over there, or did your friend just go over there and do that for you? And he gives me a different answer every time, as if he wants to bedevil me, which he's just right to do, because I think in marriage, you know, you need these, Lawrence always says, you know, let's keep a little mystery.
Yes.
And, you know, it doesn't hurt to keep a little mystery in a marriage or in romance. You know, I never get bored with him. He bedevils me, but he does not bore me.
Very important.
Yeah.
Oh, hi. For those who are just tuning in, you're listening to the Radio Reader Rambler. I'm your host, Sandy Harper, with my co-host, Dick Reichman. And our guest is Lee Newman, author of Still Points North, a wonderful new book just published. And in fact, you should not only read it for yourself, you should get your book clubs to read it. You should form a book club and read it. You know, because reading it and being an Alaskan is very special.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I love book clubs. I've been doing some book clubs, and I love talking about it with readers. Do you know what I mean? It's it's exciting. You don't imagine that when you're a writer, that, you know, or at least I don't. I don't think you can write when you're thinking about the reader. Because if you want it to be true, right, you've got to just think about what you're doing and how do I make these sentences. But then this wonderful thing happens. Your book comes out. People come and want to talk to you about it. I'm like, okay, that sounds great. And if let's have a glass of wine and talk about the book. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it was. It is a great book to stimulate discussion in so many ways.
Yeah, I think it is, because I do think there are a lot of people. The key thing that I'm talking about, and I think a lot of Alaskans deal with this, being so self-reliant, being so independent, you know, having trouble asking for help, or, you know, your instinct is not to ask for help, but then, you know, of course, Alaskans can be very helpful. But I see this even in the lower 48, you know, as I've watched, there's all kinds of wildernesses. And what I do see is a lot of competent people. The more competent you are, sometimes the higher the chance that loneliness becomes kind of your go-to position. This improbable comfort of loneliness, I think, often comes with high competency. Because, you know, loneliness can be comforting, especially if you've been through a lot. A lot of the reasons why people are so competent is that they were forced to figure it out early, and they either felt that they didn't have anybody to ask for help, or they actually didn't have anybody to ask for help, you know? And so it's hard to, you know, when loneliness is your teddy bear, you know, it's hard to break up with that teddy bear. In fact, I'm not sure whether you have to break up with him. You can get it. You just got to get like stuffed lamb, you know?
Being
comfortable with loneliness, being okay with doing things on your own, being okay with being strong and assertive, but, you know, saying it sometimes, hey, you know, can I have a little help here? Or, gee, I really like you, you know, can we make a little time to have coffee? You know,
this is so important today, and I'm kind of worried about this generation, actually, because they're so tapped into electronics and things, or time alone is tapped into those electronic things. You're not cuddling your teddy.
I don't know, though, because social media does connect you with other people. It depends on what you think is connection, you know, I do worry about, and I've met so many Alaskans have tweeted me or Facebooked me. And I've never been involved with social media before. But just because the book came out, and they'd say, you know, I have this story. You know, my dad lived in Alaska and my mom lived in Portland, and I went between the two parents. And, you know, I understand these issues of
people identified.
Yeah, very much. And I would have never met these people, because also let's say they don't live in Portland. I'm not coming to Portland. They live in some small town in Arizona, and they, you know, went to Alaskan summer camp, and it's been great.
That is so exciting. It really is. What I was thinking, though, of, you know, when you were a kid, when I was a kid, which was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Both my parents work, so I spent a lot of time alone.
Yeah.
I'm talking about being alone.
Yeah.
And so you resort to your own imagination or your own way of doing things.
And that's a boon. I think that most of us that grew up in Alaska, you know, even if we weren't alone, and I was alone a lot of the time, and when we lived in Scenic Park, my parents would just, we'd be gone from morning, noon to night in the forest, the Chugach National Forest, just running around, you know, provoking moose, you know, eating rose hips, you know, eating dirt, fishing in streams we shouldn't have been fishing in, you know, I don't even know what in the world. I remember one time one of the kids set a big fire and we had to put it out. That was pretty, pretty awful. But we did, because we were more afraid of our parents than we were of the fire. But, you know, when you grow up in Alaska in that environment or out in the bush with my dad, you know, he'd be fishing and I'd fish for, you know, 8 hours. And then I'd get tired, you know, and I'd be goofing around and doing all kinds of stuff. I do think, I think it impacts your imagination. I think it impacts the way you view the world. I think you don't need things to amuse you. You know, you literally can be amused by some what we used to call mermaid foam. In the creeks, you know, that foam that, I don't know what I would call it, mermaid foam, that foam that sort of, that brown foam, or just even, I used to just sit there trying to trap minnows with my fingers. Of course, I knew that I was never going to trap it, you know, but I would do that for hours, you know, hours. We're making little mud houses.
Yeah, all those pleasures of childhood.
Yes. But you don't, when you're stuck alone and there's really nowhere to go for 8 hours or 9 hours or 10 hours or 4 days, while dad's fishing, you know, it really trains your mind to think in that way. And I think actually that is why I'm convinced why there's so much Great Alaskan Writing coming out. Is I think that there's some correspondence with the ability to amuse yourself for hours and being able to sit at a desk and amuse yourself with words for hours. And that's why these great, I mean, it just feels like all these Alaskan books are coming out, all this Alaskan writing is coming out. It's exciting.
It really is. It really is. So, and thank you for helping it along to share with the Lower 48.
Thank you very much.
Well, because, you know, people can write about their own region, their own unique experience, their own connections. Mm-hmm. You used to feel, I guess, when you were like, well, I got to go to New York if I'm going to be a writer.
No, I didn't. I didn't feel that way. I kind of ended up there on accident. Mm. And I'm there because I married my husband, who's a diehard New Yorker and is resisting all attempts for me to dislodge us into the wilderness. Although I periodically will take him to Idaho and say, oh, look at this house. It's $30,000. We can move to Idaho. He's going on a helicopter tour today. I'm trying to convince him to move to Alaska.
Is Brooklyn considered the suburbs? Or that's still New York in your mind?
Yeah, it is. I consider it very much New York.
Okay. You know, we're winding down. We have such a short time, and you have so much to share. But, you know, your author's note in this book I thought was absolutely wonderful, and I wonder if you would share that with us before we
author's
have to
note.
Leave.
Everything in this book really happened, even the flooded tent, the rapid-filled canyon, and the king salmon. I've changed everyone's name, so if you see yours in here, you can feel confident that it's not you. I also changed some of the chronology in order to make for a more smoothly flowing story. My life did not fit into a tidy narrative, especially when it came to the ceaseless and undocumented stream of countries I visited. And the last scene with my father contains dialogue from several different conversations. Please also know that although certain bits of outdoor lore are presented here as advice, for example, the only way to survive a grizzly encounter is to run away very, very quickly, they may not, in fact, ensure your survival.
Thank you, Leigh, so much. It's been such a pleasure to have you as our guest on the Alaska Radio Reader Rambler. You're welcome. And join us again next month for another edition of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler.